Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident that's going into our radiology. This will be the 96th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's episode, we'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 1 exam. I believe this will be Series 5, and I'm going to be focusing on neuro. And again, note, this is not, obviously you should use this to review for your Step 1 exam, but this is not part of the comprehensive neuro review series that I'm going to be continuing on. And I promise I will continue that. I'll finish that up. It's just timing. I'm on a fairly intense medicine rotation right now, and then I'm jumping right into ICU, so it just makes things a little difficult. So let's just get right into it. So what if you get a question about a patient that has like increased intracranial pressures? They have like obstructive hydrocephalus, and they tell you that you see a mass, and then you, let's assume you do like a biopsy or whatever, and then on histology you find like perivascular pseudo rosettes on histology. What kind of brain tumor are you thinking about? Really hope you're thinking about an ependymoma with that. Okay, now what if you get a question about a patient, let's say it's a baby, has a like really bad like chronic headaches, or let's say it's like a young kid, really bad chronic headaches, and let's assume this child, let's not make it a baby. Let's say it's a really bad chronic headaches, and this patient's hematocrit is like 18 grams per deciliter. Normal hematocrit is about like 12, 13, maybe 14 max. So let's assume this person has like really high hematocrit. What are you thinking about here? What kind of brain tumor are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a brain tumor that produces EPO, which will be a hemangioblastoma, right? It'll be a hemangioblastoma. Remember, hemangioblastomas can produce EPO as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. And remember that hemangioblastomas, right, they usually show up in the posterior fossa in kids. And they're associated with like VHL, right? So like von Hippel or Lindau. It's like an autosomal dominant disorder. Remember, those people also tend to have like multiple other problems. Like they can have like the hemangioblastomas, as I just mentioned. They can also have like early onset like bilateral renal cell carcinoma, especially like the clear cell kind of a renal cell carcinoma. So those are all things you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind with a VHL. I remember that renal cell carcinoma as well can also produce EPO as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. And also like a liver cancer, right? So like hepatocellular carcinoma can also produce an EPO as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. Now, what is the, facial finding that will be associated with a lesion to the trigeminal nerve? Well, I really hope you're thinking about like your jaw deviation. Where does your jaw deviate? Does it deviate towards or away from the lesion? It deviates towards the side of the lesion, right? So again, something to keep in mind, just a quick thing to remember there. Now, what would the oropharyngeal finding be in a patient that has like a vagus nerve lesion? Think about deviation of the uvula. What do you think? The uvula will deviate towards or away. What do you think? It will deviate away from the side of the lesion. The thing is, the pathophysiology behind these like two things, again, this is a rapid review, but I promise when I get to those neuro comprehensive and neuro reviews, I'll talk about it, I promise. I'm obsessed with neuro, so we'll talk about it down the line. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, sort of has like a shoulder droop on their right side, so they have like right shoulder droop, and then they have difficulty turning their head to the left? What's the cranial nerve that's lesioned and on what side, right? So this patient has a cranial 11 lesion, right? So they have a lesion of the spinal accessory nerve. And if you want to be a little more exact, it'll be a lesion to the right spinal accessory nerve, because the thing is, you have shoulder droop on the ipsilateral side to the lesion, and then you have difficulty turning your head to the contralateral side as the lesion, right? Because remember, one of the muscles you need to turn your head is like your sternocleidomastoid muscle, right? So it's all screwed up when you have a cranial 11 lesion. So shoulder droop on the ipsilateral side to the lesion cranial nerve, and then you have problems turning your head to the contralateral side. So those are different ways they can test the same thing. Okay, now what is the oropharyngeal lesion that will be associated with the lesion to, the hypoglossal nerve, so cranial 12. So think more about your tongue deviation. Where does your tongue deviate? It deviates towards the side of the lesion, right? So remember like kind of like licking your wounds. That's a nice fancy way to remember that. Okay, now What if you get a question about like a Harvard student that sort of presents to the emergency room, and this Harvard student has a facial droop, right? So think of Harvard student, Harvard. Where is Harvard? Harvard is in Boston, right? So it's in New England, right? So what does this patient have? Well, I hope you're thinking about Bell's palsy, right? So remember, like, Lyme disease can cause like Bell's palsy. I remember, again, New England, so like Maryland, Connecticut, Boston, New York potentially, right? Those are New Hampshire, right? Maine. Those are like classic places where people can get, Rhode Island as well. Those are classic places where people can get a Lyme disease, right? So whenever they give you like geography on MBMEs, they're not giving you for the fun of it, right? It actually like means something towards the answer. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a patient and they have like pupils that do not respond to light, but they can accommodate, and they tell you that this patient has like a brainstem mass, right? So again, this person's pupils don't respond to light, but the patient has like intact accommodation, and they have like a mass in the brainstem. What kind of mass are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about like a pineloma, right? With like pyrenoid syndrome. Remember, the pineal gland is superior to the superior colliculus. And remember that around that superior colliculus area, you also have like your pretectal nucleus. And your pretectal nucleus, it's like directly above the midbrain. It's a part of the midbrain. It actually helps with your pupillary light reflex, okay? So if you have like a mass compressing the superior colliculus, it could potentially involve the pretectal nucleus. So you have problems with your pupillary light reflex, right? So that's why this patient in this question has pupils that do not necessarily respond to light, okay? Just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if you get a question about like a bitemporal or hemianopsia in a child? What kind of brain mass are you thinking about? Craniopharyngioma, right? Remember I talked about it in the previous rapid review series. I think it was like series 4, something like that, for step 1, right? Remember your adamantinomatous or craniopharyngiomas. Don't forget they're derived from a Ratke's pouch, right? So they can compress the optic chiasm and cause a bitemporal hemianopsia. So basically like tunnel vision, right? So that's an example of a heteronymous hemianopsia. Okay, now what if you get a question about an adult that has like bitemporal hemianopsia, and let's say they've stopped having their menstrual periods, or let's say it's a guy and he has like galactorrhea, so like a guy that's like basically like peeing out milk from his breasts. What are you thinking about, right? I hope you're thinking about a prolactinoma, right? Or if they don't put prolactinoma as an answer choice, they can put a pituitary adenoma. Remember, the most common pituitary adenoma is a prolactinoma. And how do you treat those? Hope you're thinking about like a bregolin or bromocriptine, right? Remember, those are dopamine receptor agonists. Remember, another name for dopamine is a prolactin inhibiting factor, right? In fact, that is like the first line treatment for prolactinomas. It resolves it in like, I don't know, like some ridiculous number, like 80-90% of people. But if that doesn't work, then you can try like a transphenoidal resection of the pituitary. Okay, so I think that's all I'm gonna say there. What is the most common pediatric brain tumor? That's a pilocytic astrocytoma, right? And again, remember, it's classically in the posterior fossa. A craniopharyngioma is different, though. It's a supratentorial mass. But contrast that with pilocytic astrocytoma that's usually in like your posterior fossa, like around like the cerebellum area, okay? And don't forget your classic Rosenthal fibers with a pilocytic astrocytoma. Now, what is the most common adult brain tumor? That's glioblastoma, right? So that's GBM. Glioblastoma multiforme, right? Remember, it's a GFAP positive. And the classic way they will describe it on an MBME is they will describe like a mass that's crossing the corpus callosum, right? And it has like a lot of vasogenic edema and central necrosis. Look for that boss phrase. If you see that, you really want to think about GBM. GBM is a nasty, nasty, nasty brain tumor. Okay, now, what if they tell you about a patient that has like a they tell you that, oh, they perform brain imaging and they find an extra axial mass that has a tail attached to the dura, so has a dural tail. What kind of brain tumor are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about a meningioma, okay? I hope you're thinking about a meningioma. Meningiomas, they love to attach to like derivatives of the dura, like the fog cerebri, for example, right? So if they describe like a parasagittal mass that has a dural tail, you can pretty much stop reading the question. That's a meningioma. And don't forget that your meningiomas have those fancy schmancy samoma bodies that could also be described as a laminated calcifications on an MBME exam. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a child that has like the child has to like crank up the TV like really loud so he can hear, like during an NBA game, for example, and they tell you that, oh, they perform brain imaging and they find like bilateral, like masses at the cerebellopontine angles bilaterally. What are you thinking about? What syndrome are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about NF2, right? So like neurofibromatosis type 2. And remember, it's again, it's an autosomal dominant disorder, chromosome 22 issues. Remember, NF2, chromosome 22. And those people, they can get like bilateral acoustic neuromas, right? Actually, it's kind of high yield to know that NF2 is not associated with cafe au lait spots. It's just one of those like aberrant things people sort of put in their minds for tests. It's not a thing. The neurofibromatosis syndrome that has cafe au lait spots and like actual neurofibromas is NF1. In NF2, you don't have cafe au lait spots. In NF2, you do not have neurofibromas, okay? So those are high yield things you want to keep in mind for exams. Okay, now, what if you get a question about since I talked about NF2, I remember that those people can, they can also get meningiomas as well. But most commonly think about the bilateral acoustic neuromas or acoustic schwannomas or whatever. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a child that, you know, sort of has like a truncal ataxia, and they tell you that on brain imaging, they see like a mid-cerebellar mass. What tumor are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a medulloblastoma. Remember, medulloblastomas, they love growing in the cerebellum. It's a posterior fossa mass. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it is the second most common pediatric brain tumor after a pilocytic astrocytoma. So medulloblastomas, they love to grow in the cerebellum. So they almost always present with ataxia. In fact, if you see a question about a kid that's presenting with ataxia, right, and like chronic headaches, I really want you to think about a medulloblastoma if you don't see a pilocytic astrocytoma as an answer choice. I will say that usually brain tumor in a kid with ataxia, almost like 90 to 95% of the time on MBME exams, it's a medulloblastoma. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a kid, you know, that has a brain tumor and you perform a biopsy and you find a lesion that has solid and cystic components? What kind of tumor are you thinking about? This tumor is derived from Racky's pouch. That's a craniopharyngioma, okay? I'm just basically think of this as the brain tumor rapid review. Although, obviously, I'm going to talk about some other high-yield stuff, but this stuff, it's like easy points on an exam if you can just recognize the buzzwords. Okay, now, what if you get a question about an adult, you know? This adult has like a lot of like focal, like neurological deficits, and they tell you that you see a mass in the frontal lobe. Notice the lobe I'm talking about, the frontal lobe. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? It's an oligodendroglioma. Oligodendrogliomas, they can show up in many parts of the brain, but classically on MBME exams, they show up in the frontal lobe, okay? And remember that they have that fried egg appearance on imaging, right? So, on histology, right? So it's one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, and then you see a mass crossing the corpus callosum, right? Don't forget your GBM, right? Remember this vasogenic edema, central necrosis, very high yield to know that, glioblastoma multiforme. Okay, now, what is the, I guess, property that underlies an anesthetic having a rapid onset of action? I'll give you a hint. It relates to the blood gas partition coefficient. Would it be a high blood gas partition coefficient or a low blood gas partition coefficient? It'll be a low blood gas partition coefficient, okay? If you want to, you'll be like, oh, Divine, can you explain? I encourage you to go back to my neuropharmacology podcasts. They're like back on the website. I explain this in like excruciating detail. If you understand the explanation I give in that podcast, you'll never forget the concept. Okay, now, what is the property that will underlie an anesthetic having I want to put this in a way that will not confuse you. Okay, let me put it this way. What if you're trying to compare two anesthetics, okay, and one has you know what? I don't want to confuse you guys too much. Let's put it this way. Okay, so what is the property of an anesthetic that will sort of underlie needing like a smaller amount of that anesthetic for a given, like a fixed effect? What will that be? That would be like the lipid solubility, right? If an anesthetic has high lipid solubility, right, that means it can cross the blood-brain barrier pretty easily, right? It will have like, it'll be more potent, okay? So it'll potentially have like a lower MAC. Now, what if MAC, right, means like minimum alveolar concentration, because you don't need to give a crap ton of that anesthetic. Now, what is the anesthetic class that increases the duration of opening of GABA receptors? Right, those are your barbiturates, right? So your barbiturates, so like phenobarbital, for example. Remember, there's no reversal agent for phenobarbital. If a patient has like phenobarbital intoxication, you basically have to intubate them and pray for the best. Okay, now, what is the anesthetic class that I guess increases the frequency of opening of GABA receptors, right? That's benzodiazepine, right? Remember the mnemonic, right? That Ben likes to have it more frequently and Barb likes it to last longer, right? So so Ben, right, more frequently increases the frequency of opening. Barb lasts longer, right? So increases the duration of opening of the GABA receptor. Okay, now what if a patient, you know, they tell you that this patient was recently intubated and then their temperature is like 105, right? And they have like muscle rigidity. What's your diagnosis? That will be malignant hyperthermia, right? So remember, they've probably been intubated with something that contains like a succinylcholine or like halothane or whatever, and then they get into trouble. And while I'm on this, so they get like the malignant hyperthermia, remember, it arises from a person having either like it's like an autosomal dominant disorder, and it arises if you have like a ryanodine receptor mutation or a dihydropyridine receptor mutation. Okay, and just one quick thing, right? So I guess on the whole topic of a succinylcholine, don't forget that if you're hyper, this will be a question that I can pretty much surmise most people will get wrong on an MBM. But basically, if you're hyperkalemic, you should not get a depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent like succinylcholine. Okay, because succinylcholine, right, technically keeps the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor like open. Right. So the cell is like basically like the muscle cell is like basically like wasting its cell soup into the surrounding environment. I talk about this in my neuropharmacology podcast, but it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind, because if potassium is leaking out of the cell, remember, potassium is an intracellular ion. If it leaks out of the cell, right, you can get a worsening of hyperkalemia. So that's why these drugs, they are classically contraindicated in patients that have hyperkalemia, right? So like drugs like succinylcholine. And then another like classy one they can put on an exam is like a recent like burn victim or a patient that has like rhabdomyolysis. Those patients should also not get any kind of depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent. Because remember, if you're a burn victim, right, remember burns can cause like muscle damage and whatnot. And if you get muscle damage, muscles can release their potassium into the circulation, and that can cause a lot of trouble. Alternatively, if you have rhabdomyolysis, you have muscle cell necrosis, remember from pathoma, whenever a cell dies, right, it can explode. When it explodes, its cell soup sips into the circulation, and that can basically present as a hyperkalemia, right? So either if you have like legit hyperkalemia or you have anything that predisposes you to hyperkalemia, that is essentially a contraindication to getting a depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent on an MBME exam, okay? I know you're like, Divine, this seems low yield. I promise you it's not. I won't be saying it if it was low yield. Okay, now, what is the drug of choice in the treatment of malignant hyperthermia on an MBME, right? What do you want to give? Right, you want to give like dantrolene, right? Remember, dantrolene is basically a calcium channel blocker, right? It basically like blocks calcium channels, and that will present like, because think about it, right? If you block the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right, the muscle cell will stop. Because let me put it this way, the thing that causes a lot of the problems in malignant hyperthermia is that you have the mutations in like the ryanodine receptor or the dihydropyridine receptor. So you have like the muscle being in a hypercontractile state. So if you blocked the channel that helps you release calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, remember that is the endoplasmic reticulum of muscle, then you do not release that calcium and then the muscle does not contract, right? And that can sort of like dumb down symptoms for a while. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient that is recently intubated, and then after the intubation, their liver enzymes begin to rise like severely? What are you think? What kind of anesthetic are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about halothane, right? Remember, halothane can cause a hepatic necrosis. Remember the H in halothane for the H in hepatic, right? So that's an easy way to remember that for exams. And how do you reverse a benzo overdose? Right, you give a GABA receptor antagonist like flumazenil. Very good. Okay. And what is the reversal agent for an opioid overdose? Right, it's like naloxone or naltrexone. So here's the thing. Your friends at the MBME have been known to write questions where they put naloxone as an answer choice and they put naltrexone as an answer choice. In the same, like five answer choices, you say naloxone and naltrexone. Do not pick naltrexone. Pick naloxone. Naloxone has a faster onset of action. If you give your patient naltrexone and they have So you give your patient naltrexone and they have like opioid toxicity. Before the naltrexone kicks in, your patient will probably be dead, right? So you don't want to do that. In fact, I will tell you this: naltrexone classically on MBME exams is used in the treatment of alcohol, if a person is like addicted to alcohol, that is when you give naltrexone on MBME exams. You classically do not use naltrexone to treat opioid intoxication. So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. Very, very high yield to know that. You want to give naloxone, not naltrexone. Okay, and naloxone is like a mu opioid receptor antagonist, right? Because remember, your friends at the MBME, they love you to know those opioid receptors and their agonists, right? So remember, beta endorphin is for like the mu receptor, enkephalin is for the delta receptor, right? So it's just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. There's one more opioid receptor, I believe it's, it's the kappa receptor, and the kappa receptor has dynorphine as its agonist, okay? You may say, again, Divine, these things are high yield. I promise you, I've seen this tested multiple times, right? So kappa receptor, dynorphine as its agonist, delta receptor, enkephalin as its agonist, and then the mu opioid receptor has beta endorphin as its endogenous agonist. So these are things that all exist in the brain. And one more weird thing you want to sort of keep at the back of your mind with beta endorphin is that beta endorphin is also derived from a compound known as POMC, so pro-opio-melanocortin. Why is it important to know about POMC, right? So POMC, right, is a precursor to three high yield things you want to know for your MBME exam. You want to know that POMC is a precursor to ACTH, okay? POMC is a precursor to MSH or melanocyte stimulating hormone, and POMC is a precursor to beta endorphin. And you may say, Divine, how do I remember all this crap? Well, actually, there is a nice way to remember it. If you literally see what POMC stands for, POMC stands for pro-opio-melanocortin. If you break down those words, opioid, right? So opioid agonists like beta endorphin. Melanocyte stimulating hormone, and then melanocortin, right, like a corticotropin, like ACTH, which is adrenocorticotropic hormone, okay? So that's a nice way to sort of remember that, if you sort of break it up nicely. And don't forget, right, another reason POMC is important is if a person has like Addison's disease, right, so like primary adrenal insufficiency, and the adrenal cortex is not working, right, those people will have like elevated ACTH because there's no negative feedback from cortisol because they're not making cortisol. But another thing they will have is like skin hyperpigmentation, because if you're making ACTH, right, ACTH has to come from somewhere. You can't like pull ACTH from thin air, right? So the ACTH actually comes from like the POMC. If it comes from the POMC, as you're making a, because you're making a ton of ACTH, you need to make a ton of POMC. So if you're making a ton of ACTH, you'll be making a ton of you'll be making a ton of MSH as well, right? So you stimulate your melanocytes and you get the skin hyperpigmentation. The skin hyperpigmentation is something that can help you tell between primary adrenal insufficiency versus secondary adrenal insufficiency. In fact, one of the series I'll be starting on the USMLE Step 1, where like literally I cover it in detail like I did for like biochem and I've done for renal, will be endocrine. I'll start an endocrine review relatively soon. Okay, now, what is the enzyme that breaks down succinylcholine? This is just a factoid question to know. That would be pseudocholinesterase, okay? And what is the question, what is the anesthetic, I guess, that has this property where the patient will have like no pain, so it's like a great anesthetic. They have no memory of the event, but they are completely awake when under anesthesia, right? So it's like a dissociative anesthetic. What kind of drug are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about ketamine, okay? Ketamine. And then remember I talked about succinylcholine being a depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent. Don't forget your non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent, right? So these are drugs like they all end in like corium or coronium. So like rocuronium, vecuronium, pancuronium. Pancuronium is kind of like on shortage because they used to use it for like lethal injections or so, like some weird crap. So tubocurarin is another one as well. Okay. And actually, how do opioids work? This is just something that people don't really understand. But you're sort of using this question as a lead into another question. So how do opioids work, right? So you know that opioids are opioid receptor agonists, right? So like mu receptor agonists, right? The thing is, when you bind to the mu receptor, the thing that happens is the mu receptor is coupled to a signaling cascade that leads to the opening of potassium channels. So when those potassium channels open, right, when those potassium channels open, the cell basically hyperpolarizes, right? Because as the potassium channels open, remember potassium is primarily an intracellular ion, so the potassium flows out of the cell stops firing, and that sort of quiets down the neuron. Okay, so that is how opioids work. So this is actually why clonidine can be used in the treatment of opioid withdrawal, right? But let me backtrack a little here, right? So I said opioids will act on mu receptors. They act on those mu receptors. Those mu receptors cause the opening of potassium channels. And when you open potassium channels, potassium flows out of the cell. So the cell hyperpolarizes and basically shuts down, right? So that's high yield to know. And the thing is, when the cell hyperpolarizes, right, if it's like a sympathetic neuron, right, so like a postganglionic sympathetic neuron, right, by hyperpolarizing that cell, you have a decreased release of catecholamines, right? So that is sort of how, if you understand that mechanism, you'll see why clonidine is used in the treatment of opioid withdrawal. And the reason behind that is clonidine basically works like an opioid. The only thing is it works through a different receptor to achieve the same effect. Because think about it, right? I just said that opioids bind to mu receptor, open up potassium channel, cell hyperpolarizes. If you give clonidine, remember clonidine is an alpha-2 agonist, right? And remember that those alpha-2 adrenergic receptors are GI coupled, right? So they are kind of G protein coupled receptor, but they are coupled to an inhibitory G protein, right? So when you give clonidine, clonidine will bind to those alpha 2 receptors. When it binds to those alpha 2 receptors, it will activate GI. When it activates GI, you have like a basically like a decreased you basically have like an inhibition of adenylate cyclase, so you make cyclic AMP and all that stuff. So that will sort of cause like hyperpolarization of the neuron, right? And if you hyperpolarize that neuron, then it will stop releasing catecholamines, right? So basically, it's like clonidine is acting like is giving you the same ultimate effect, decreased release of norepinephrine from a neuron, but it's acting through like a different signaling cascade, through a different receptor. So it's working through an alpha 2 receptor versus an opioid that works through a mu receptor. In fact, that's why clonidine is like a street drug, because basically, if you're going through opioid withdrawal, if you take clonidine, most of those symptoms will effectively disappear. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind. And while I'm on this topic, a brilliant idea just came to my mind. A closely related concept where you get the same effect from something through two different receptors is also the concept of treating like an overdose of a beta blocker. So remember, beta receptors, right, especially like beta 2 receptors, those receptors, they work through a G protein coupled receptor as well, right? So if, for example, you give a beta agonist, it can act on that beta 2 receptor, activate G sub S, you activate adenylate cyclase, you make more cyclic AMP and all that fun stuff, right? So the thing is, if a person overdoses on a beta blocker, one problem they have is basically, if you look downstream of the receptor, they have a decreased activity of cyclic AMP because they're not making as much cyclic AMP, right? So that's a problem. So if you could potentially give something that will act on a different kind of receptor that is not a beta receptor, or would up basically prop up your levels of cyclic AMP, then that can fix a beta blocker overdose, right? So the classic drug in this case will be glucagon, right? Glucagon acts on a glucagon receptor. And it so happens that that glucagon receptor is a G protein coupled receptor, and it's GS coupled, right? So when glucagon acts on that G protein coupled receptor, that will increase the release of cyclic AMP. So you're basically getting like a beta agonist like effect, but you're getting it through a different receptor. That is the mechanism behind glucagon being the reversal agent for overdose on a beta blocker. Okay, so I know I've rambled for a bit, but I promise you all these things are floridly high yield for the USMLE exams. Okay, and I promise I will be ending this podcast relatively soon, right? And then I guess some easy questions to round things out. What is the motor area of the cerebral cortex? That's the precentral gyrus, right? And then what's the sensory area of the cerebral cortex? That'll be the postcentral gyrus, right? That's pretty easy. Now, let's do some vascular stuff real quick. What is the arterial lesion that will lead to like a contralateral lower extremity, like weakness and paralysis? That'll be the anterior cerebral artery, right? Because remember, if you look at your homunculus, right? So like in the middle of the brain, like sort of close to the middle of the cerebral cortex, sort of close to the fork cerebri, right? That's where you have like your leg area in the homunculus. And remember that that leg area is supplied by the anterior cerebral artery, right? So if you have like a stroke of the anterior cerebral artery, that can cause contralateral lower extremity weakness, right? Because remember, if you infarct that part of your cerebral cortex, the reason you get contralateral symptoms is because remember that your corticospinal tract will start in the cortex, but it will decussate at the level of the pyramids, right? So because of that decussation, right, you'll have like contralateral symptoms. Okay, now, what is the arterial lesion that will lead to like upper extremity or like facial weakness and paralysis? What kind of artery are you thinking about? That's the middle cerebral artery, right, the MCA. Because again, think back to your homunculus, your face and arm area is in MCA territory. And remember, this is actually a factor you want to know with regards to the middle cerebral artery. Whenever a person has an embolic stroke, the most commonly occluded artery is the middle cerebral artery. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient that can understand what is spoken, but they stutter in response? What kind of aphasia do they have? That is Broca's aphasia. Okay, good. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, speaks fluently, but basically says gibberish, right? So most of what they say is like senseless. What kind of aphasia is that? That's a Wernicke's aphasia. Okay, so that's more of like a sensory aphasia versus Broca, that's more of like an expressive aphasia. Okay, now, if a patient has a lesion to the frontal eye field, in what direction will their eyes deviate? The eye will actually deviate towards the lesion side, right? So let's just sort of walk through this, right? So let's talk about the normal first. So basically, your frontal eye field projects, it's in your cerebral cortex, it projects to the contralateral PPRF, the contralateral paramedian pontine reticular formation. And then the contralateral PPRF activates the So this is looking from the perspective of the PPRF. The contralateral PPRF will signal to like the abducens nucleus on the same side. So cranial 6 on the same side as the PPRF and cranial 3 on the opposing side as the PPRF. So I think to make things a little clearer, let's just pick one side. So let's say we're talking about the right frontal eye field. Your right frontal eye field, okay, which is in the cerebral cortex, projects to your left paramedian pontine reticular formation, okay? And your left paramedian pontine reticular formation projects to your left abducens nerve, okay? And your right oculomotor nerve, okay? Because the whole point behind that system is if you want to have like conjugate horizontal gaze, right? Because think about it. If your right frontal eye field projects to your left PPRF and your left PPRF projects to your left abducens nerve and your right oculomotor nerve, by projecting to your left abducens nerve, right, that means your lateral rectus for your left eye would abduct. And then by projecting to your right oculomotor nerve, that means your medial rectus for your right eye will cause adduction. So you have abduction of your left eye and a deduction of your right eye, right? So that means you basically look to the left, right? So your right frontal eye field controls your ability to look left, right? Again, right frontal eye field, left PPRF controls left cranial 6 and right cranial 3. So your right frontal eye field gives you the ability to look to the left. So think about it. If you lesion your right frontal eye field, you lose your ability to look to the left. So your eyes will deviate towards the right. So your eyes are deviating towards the side of the lesion. Okay? Very high yield to understand that. This is actually one of these things that are high yield for step 1 and also high yield for step 2 and your neuro shelf in third year. Okay. Now, what if a patient has a lesion to the PPRF, in what direction will their eyes deviate? What do you think? Their eyes will actually deviate away from the side of the lesion, right? So again, very easy if you understood what I just explained. Your left PPRF controls your left cranial 6 and your right cranial 3, okay? And your left cranial 6 will cause abduction of your left eye and your right cranial 3 will cause adduction of your right eye. So your PPRF on your left side makes you look left. So if you have a lesion to your PPRF, you will lose the ability to look left. So your eyes will deviate right. So your eyes will deviate away from the side of the lesion. These are things I'll highly recommend. Just sort of write it down and try to like reason through it yourself as well. It will make sense. Okay. I know I've explained this in like maybe 2 or 3 other podcasts in the past. Whenever I devote like multiple podcasts to explain the same concept, that should probably tell you something about the importance of that question on an MBME exam. Okay, now, what is the special sensation, right? So like special sensations, like we have special sensations of like smell, of taste, and all that stuff. What is the special sensation that does not have a relay nucleus in the thalamus? That's actually the sensation of smell. Okay. And then, just I guess one thing I'll just say to round this up, because I feel like this is probably going on for a little longer than I planned for. But basically, if you have like a lesion to like your prefrontal cortex, you basically begin to have like reemergence of like primitive reflexes. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. And again, as I round up, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, and Step 3. And then like preclinical med school exams, and then like third year shelf exams, and what else do I tutor? I also tutor like the medicine in training exam and the medicine board exam, so like for medicine residents. You may say, Divine, how do you tutor these things? And you're just a TY. Just send me an email and I'll do some explaining. And then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application or a med student applying to residency, so an ERAS application, I do offer like consulting for that, like interview prep, personal statements, preparing your application, because I mean, I've been on the admissions committee for a top two med school for a year, so I have a lot of experience with that. And like I said, this current cycle of people that just matched, pretty much everyone I advised matched. So I guess take that for what you will. And then if you weirdly have like an acquaintance that's studying for like organic chemistry or general chemistry or physics or physiology or biochem, I do offer tutoring for those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day, and I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a great week, and God bless you. Thanks.